Well, this year sees the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade. So there are going to be many Wilberforce commemorations during the course of the year. And it's anticipated that one son of Yorkshire, himself a member of Parliament, will mark the memory of an illustrious predecessor on both counts. I'm speaking of William Hague, will follow his acclaimed biography of William Pitt the Younger, which came out not so long ago, with another biography, this time of William Wilberforce, a little later this year. Now, in fact, the anniversary that we're anticipating this year will be partial on two counts. Firstly, 207 does not mark the abolition of slavery. We do need to be aware of that. That only took place in 1833, a matter of days before the death of William Wilberforce, but the abolition of the slave trade, that is the buying and selling of human captives. And secondly, when Wilberforce deliberately set out on a distinctly Christian and moral vocation in public life, he actually had more than one string to his bow. On October the 28th, 1787, he wrote these words in his diary: "God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners." Now, in the English of the day, that phrase, the reformation of manners, is a phrase that goes right back to Puritan times, a century or so beforehand, and it means that he was concerned for the moral tone of society at large. He saw it as his duty to engage in what evangelical Christians in America nowadays call the culture wars. In other words, he had something even bigger in mind than simply taking on the single issue of the abolition of the slave trade. He was a social pioneer in all sorts of areas, including things as diverse as preventing cruelty to animals. He helped to found what eventually became the RSPCA, outlawing the use of climbing boys as chimney sweeps, and a great many more things besides. But central to all of this was the fact that William Wilberforce was a Christian man. You can't simply think of him as an upright man, or a good man, or as a moral man. And if you want to understand what made William Wilberforce tick, it's helpful to remember that as a politician, he did something which is almost unthinkable in modern terms. He actually wrote a work of theology. And in his own lifetime, it was a bestseller. You can't imagine a Member of Parliament doing that nowadays. It was entitled A Practical View of Christianity. He wrote it in the year 1797. By the way, it had a considerably longer title than that. That's the short version. And it went through a good many printings, and it was translated into a number of foreign languages. But in that book, Wilberforce made the point that you can't simply attempt to change society for the better without changing people at their very core. And Wilberforce himself had been through such a change. He used to refer to it as the Great Change. Now, what I'd like to do first of all is to try and sum up about 25 years of the man's life in 10 minutes. So, if you'll forgive me, first of all, a kind of brief roller coaster ride. Now, Wilberforce was born in the city of Hull in the year 1759. It was a year of noted military victories against the French on sea and land. He could trace his surname back, actually, to the 12th century, to a soldier who fought the Scots under King Henry II. It was originally spelt Wilberforce, and it's a name of some antiquity in the East Riding. He was from a wealthy merchant family who had grown rich on the Baltic trade in Eastern Europe. But at around the time of his 9th birthday, his father had died, and he was sent to London to live with an uncle and aunt. His uncle and aunt, his uncle was himself, William, and his aunt was called Hannah, had been considerably influenced by one of the great evangelical preachers of the day. This was a man named George Whitfield. And they were also friends with a certain John Newton, the author of the hymn Amazing Grace. John Newton himself, of course, was the Reformed slave ship captain. Now, while still a boy, the young Wilberforce was exposed to visits in the home of his uncle and aunt, and they gravitated between two homes, one on Wimbledon Common and one in the centre of London, where John Newton used to perform what he called his parlour preaching. He used to visit the home, and uncle and aunt would gather the family servants around, together with little William, upon whom they doted, for basically sort of family times of prayer and Bible reading. This was the parlour preaching of which he spoke. And this included expositions of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. And they made something of a pet of this little lad who'd been bereaved of his father. The tone of William's letters home developed an increasingly pious note, and this began to alarm Wilberforce's mother back home in Hull, and his grandfather, who was noted to have said, "If Billy turns Methodist, he shan't have sixpence of mine." And the decision was taken to send the mother back down to London to get him back to Hull as quickly as possible, as one phrase was used, to scrub his soul clean of Methodism. We ought to point out, by the way, that the word Methodism was a catch-all term used in the 18th century simply to mean anything like enthusiastic Christianity. The word wasn't associated at that time with one particular denomination of Christians in the way that it's come to be used nowadays. So back he went to Hull, and he found this rather difficult to take at that time. He'd grown to love his uncle and aunt. You've got to bear in mind, of course, he was a little lad who had had this awful experience of bereavement, and at one stage it had looked as though his mother was going to die as well. When he got back to Hull, he was sent away to a school at Pocklington in the East Riding, he was immersed as well in a round of social activities where his parents wanted him to get on in the world, and frankly they tried to make life as pleasurable for him as possible, but in a way that evangelical people would regard as being frankly worldly. He put it in this way: "My religious impressions continued for some time after my return to Hull, but no pains were spared to stifle them by taking me a great deal into company and to places of amusement. I might almost venture to say that no pious parent ever laboured more to impress a beloved child with sentiments of religion than was done to give me a taste for the world and its diversions. At first all this was very distasteful to me, but by degrees I acquired a relish for it, and so the good seed was gradually smothered, and I became as thoughtless as any amongst them." The headmaster, by the way, at Pocklington School was a gentleman called the Reverend Kingsman Basket, which you might say was a name and a half, really, but it turns out that William was naturally gifted and was able to coast through his education at that stage. He developed an 11th hour attitude to his studies. He would basically laze his way through his education and then cram at the last moment, and was able to go to St. John's College, and he continued his education there on the same basis. Incidentally, one or two other points. His parents were extremely wealthy. By modern standards, he would have been a millionaire, and he was also a young man of extremely tiny stature. He stood, I think, at around about 5'2". And he was naturally charming and sociable. When he got to college at Cambridge, the story ran that he always kept what was described as a great Yorkshire pie in his rooms. And other students would note that even late at night, if he heard the sound of the student whose rooms were back to back with his, and they heard the sound of the fire being raked up for the night, he would call through. It was fatal, really. If Wilberforce heard that you were going to bed, he would call and summon you, and then you'd be kept up all night talking. He had a fine singing voice. He was naturally charming and friendly, and was well liked. It was only in his final year, however, at Cambridge, that he got some inkling of what he wanted to do with his future. He got to know a young man named William Pitt, moved in the same circle, and decided that he would like to be a politician. He decided, incidentally, in later years, that his whole time at St. John's had been wasted, and he felt that really, that none of his tutors had treated him properly, in the sense that they'd pulled him up short. Why should a young man of means like you, Wilberforce, bother with studies when you're so well set up financially? Why give yourself to fagging, as the term was, meaning serious study? And it was because of this that he stood for election in his home constituency. Hull was a parliamentary borough. Now, in the electoral system of the day, not every borough was a parliamentary borough. That meant it had the right to return two men to parliament. Elections at that time were rough and ready affairs. Not everybody had the right to vote. Of course, no women did, to start with. And you could only vote at all if you had property. The idea was that if you didn't have a property qualification, you wouldn't vote responsibly. You had nothing to lose, you see. You would only vote responsibly if you had, as the phrase went, a stake in the country. You know, if you had a certain amount of property, you would then lose something if the country was run badly. And therefore, the minimum qualification was 40 shillings worth of freehold property per annum. And Hull was a parliamentary borough. Wilberforce stood, and victory cost him something in the region of £9,000 at current value. The vote of a resident elector in Hull, at least, it was figured, cost him something like 2 guineas a vote. But among other things, he had to travel to London to buy the votes of an awful lot of people who were entitled to vote in Hull, but who'd moved down to London to earn their livings. So what he had to do was to go down to London to persuade them to travel up to Hull on election day to cast their votes there. So he had to pay them to vote, he had to pay their travel expenses to get them there, he also had to pay money to pay their food, to put on handsome and lavish meals and that sort of thing. And 47 years later, on the last tour that he made of Yorkshire, he was met in Huddersfield by an old man who remembered an ox roast in the grounds of the family home, and remembered someone calling out, Mr. Wilberforce and Miss Wilberforce forever. The Miss Wilberforce in question was his younger sister Sarah, known in the family as Sally, who had the presence of mind to call out, not Miss Wilberforce forever, I hope. That was the way that elections could be at the time. There was even an incident during the election when someone suggested that he should recruit the services of a butcher whose name was Johnny Bell. Why should I get his help? Oh, sir, he's a fine fellow if it comes to a bit of bruising. You know, if you need to persuade people by means other than bribing them to vote for you. Now, while on the hustings, someone threw a stone at Wilberforce. It missed, but this Johnny Bell recognised who'd thrown the stone and came up to Wilberforce subsequently, said, "I know the man, I'll kill him if you want." Wilberforce said that that wouldn't be necessary, it'd be enough for you to find him and frighten him a little. That will give you some idea that it's the difference it made in 1872, which was the first year that an Act of Parliament was passed to guarantee the secret ballot. It was only after that that bribery at election time became meaningless. You know, when factory owners and so on, for instance, couldn't tell their employees who they should vote for. You see how important a secret ballot can be. Now, after the election, and amazingly Wilberforce won, he and William Pitt were part of the same circle of friends, and Pitt essentially entered Parliament on a ticket that he opposed the war that was going on at the time between England and the rebels in the American colonies, the 13 British colonies in North America, which wanted their independence. The Prime Minister of the day was a man named Lord North, who some Britons thought was conducting the war rather badly. And Pitt and Wilberforce together opposed that. And Wilberforce, for all that he was a small man, acquired a reputation as being something of a parliamentary bruiser. If you think back 20 years or so to the way that Lord Tebbit had a reputation at that time as being a tough guy in the House of Commons, a man who took no prisoners and spoke his mind, that was the kind of reputation that Wilberforce acquired at the time. You might say that he acquired the sort of reputation as being Pitt's Rottweiler, I suppose, wouldn't be unfair. And frankly, in those days he made enemies because of his capacity for invective. His way with words was very effective, but there were those in Parliament who cordially hated him for it, among whom was one of the most notorious politicians of the day, Charles James Fox. Nonetheless, it was during this period that something very big was going on inside Wilberforce, and it all happened during the recess in the year 1785. It was 1784-85, across that winter, when Wilberforce decided to make a lengthy tour of the continent. It was a common practice at that time for people who were moderately wealthy, and it was for the sake of a family holiday. Wilberforce was going to take his mother, his sister, and other female members of the family. They were going to cross the Channel to a various countries, and looking for an agreeable male companion to travel in his carriage, he thought initially of a man named Dr. William Burrough of York, a warm-hearted, sociable friend whose company he particularly enjoyed. When this man could not make the journey, he then thought initially of his former tutor from Hull Grammar School, a man who'd taught him, but a man who was not that much older than he was. And this was a man named Isaac Milner. Now, he hadn't realised that in the meantime, Isaac Milner had become a man of evangelical convictions. If he'd realised that, he wouldn't have asked him. Because by now, for all the fact that Wilberforce had, during his boyhood, had some exposure through his aunt and uncle to John Newton, he'd given up that sort of thing. While in London as a politician, he used to attend a church that was Unitarian. Now, you probably are aware that the Unitarianism is almost dead nowadays. It's almost disappeared from the landscape. But the Unitarians in the 18th century were the sort of theological liberals of the day. They denied the Trinity. And Wilberforce went to a church where a man named Theophilus Lindsay was the minister. They denied, of course, the Holy Trinity. Now, Milner is an intriguing character. 9 years older than Wilberforce, there was a marked contrast between the two men. Milner was huge, physically, a great bear of a man. And as a young man, his circumstances were modest. He'd been apprenticed to a weaver, but he became an eminent academic. He was a fellow of Queen's College at Cambridge, my old college. He became too a fellow of the Royal Society, became Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at Cambridge. And he was able to disarm Wilberforce's prejudices against evangelicals. But it has to be said, it took some time. The two men met for dinner at Scarborough before setting out for the continent. And the subject came up in discussion about a man named Stillingfleet, an evangelical clergyman. And Wilberforce happened to mention that he thought he was a good man, but one who took things too far. And Milner just said, oh, not a bit too far, I think. And at that point, Wilberforce began to think, oh dear, what have we got here? You know, is he going to be one of these God-botherers? And have I asked the right friend to go with me on holiday? Am I going to be cooped up in a carriage with one of these evangelical types? Now, when they got on the continent, Wilberforce began, really, the tussle and started to use some of his parliamentary invective against evangelical Christianity. And Milner replied at one point, Wilberforce, I don't pretend to be a match for you in this sort of running fire, but if you really wish to discuss these topics in a serious and argumentative manner, I shall be most happy to enter on them with you. Now, argumentative in 18th century English didn't mean argumentative in the sense of having a row about it. It meant in the sense of debate. And what happened from then on is that increasingly the two men entered into a sort of running debate for the length of their journey. And then when they got to Nice, in the south of France, they found that on the dressing table of one of the ladies who was on holiday, there was an evangelical classic of the period. It was a book by a man called Philip Doddridge. How many of you know the hymn, "Oh happy day that fixed my choice on thee, my Saviour and my God"? Well, this book was called The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. And Wilberforce just noticed it there on the table, asked what it was. Milner jumped in. Oh, it's one of the best books ever written. I suggest that we read it together for the rest of our journey. Now, actually, it was ideal as an evangelistic book for Wilberforce to read, because it was an attempt to make a presentation of the Christian faith to the educated reader. It wouldn't have done, perhaps, for the blue-collar worker of the day. Something by Richard Baxter would have been more suitable for that kind of readership. But what Doddridge had produced was ideal for the Wilberforces of the world, you know, the university-educated type. And again, the two men read it. In fact, they were so engrossed in this that the ladies began to complain. They were saying almost nothing of the menfolk on the journey. When this was over, Wilberforce had to return briefly to England, because there was parliamentary business to attend to. But when the holiday resumed, they went back by way of Switzerland, spent some time at Interlaken, and the two men began to study the Greek New Testament together. Wilberforce had New Testament Greek through his time at Cambridge. And by now, the job was almost done. And by the summer of 1785, Wilberforce felt that a personal Rubicon had almost been crossed. He needed, however, to have one issue resolved. And he felt that he needed to talk to a clergyman. Who could he ask? He only knew one. One evangelical clergyman. So he made an appointment to go and see John Newton. And he went to the vestry of his church in London, St. Mary Woolnoth. Sad to think that that church now is a place attended by a tiny handful of Anglo-Catholics. But he went there one Sunday and popped into the vestry and asked if he could see Newton at home for some conversation with him. It was a very nervous letter, and he hedged it about with so many pleas for secrecy. I've got to see you in secret. My face is well known in London. This was the argument. I'm a member of Parliament. People will know who I am. And when the appointment was kept, he was so nervous, he walked past Newton's front door in both directions more than once before he stopped, knocked, and went in. And Newton made it clear, "I've been praying for this moment for many years." And what was on Wilberforce's mind, actually, was that he felt, you see, that if he, as it were, to use the modern phrase, came out and became a decided Christian, he would have to give up his parliamentary career. But Newton began to argue with him, there is no reason why that should be necessary. And he used a number of Old Testament parallels. Joseph served God in public life. Daniel served God in public life. You can stay where you are. What clinched it, as well as that conversation with John Newton, was another conversation, actually, with his parliamentary colleague and friend, William Pitt. William Pitt, the busiest man in England, by now Prime Minister, who made a detour, and remember that a detour was not half an hour in the car as it would be nowadays, but half a day's detour. And Pitt assured him that his personal regard, although Pitt was by no means an evangelical himself, his personal regard for him would be by no means diminished if he felt that he had to embrace evangelical sentiments. And Wilberforce, for his part, felt that from now on he could not exclusively be, as he put it, a party man. You know, that the disciplines of party loyalty would sometimes have to give way to his sense of loyalty to Christ. Well, that's essentially the story of what Wilberforce came to call his great change, in a nutshell. And some few years later, he summed all this up in his book, The Practical View of Christianity. I wish I had time to talk with you about that, but I think we must move on to the story of the abolition of the slave trade. There's so much more one could tell about that first half of the story, and I wish we had time, but that brings us to the 20-year-long marathon, because that's in effect what it was. Soon after Christmas, 1787, just before Parliament broke up, Wilberforce gave notice that he would introduce a bill in the new session, but it would in fact be 20 years of unremitting effort before the first hurdle was cleared and the trade in slaves was made illegal. Very early in the new year, however, it turned out that Wilberforce became very seriously ill and went to Bath in the hope that the medicinal waters might effect a cure. His doctors prescribed opium. It was a fatal step because he became dependent upon it for the rest of his life. It seems that he was suffering at the time from ulcerative colitis, and at one point was advised to put his affairs in order. He was not expected to live beyond a fortnight. So he asked Pitt to take up the cause of abolition if he should die, and for some while went through periods when he was hallucinating badly. Now, in the event, about 6 months down the road, he recovered enough to address the Commons in May of 1789. It's interesting to note that this is the year of the French Revolution. "I confess to you, so enormous, so dreadful, so irremediable did its wickedness appear, that my own mind was completely made up for abolition. Let the consequences be what they would, I from this time determined that I would never rest until I had effected its abolition." Now, it turned out that his case was always well briefed and well documented, and he was able to explain the figures involved as Africans were transplanted from their homes via the notorious Middle Passage. Now, to explain what's meant by Middle Passage, the slave trade operated as part of a triangle. Three English ports were chiefly involved. They were Bristol and Liverpool and, for a time, Lancaster. Lancaster was not involved as much as the other two, because Lancaster was a small port and was tidal and eventually silted up and ceased to be involved as long as the other two. But essentially, ships from Britain took trade goods, things like firearms, axes, cooking pots, to West Africa. That's the first leg of the triangle. And there they collected African captives. The African captives had often been rounded up by Muslim Arabs or by other African tribes in internecine wars between African tribes, and were then shipped across the Atlantic in the Middle Passage. That's the phrase there. They were taken initially to the West Indies, the West Indian Islands, which is why when you look at West Indians, they have the same ethnic appearance as black Africans, or sometimes to the what are now the southern states of the United States of America, what were then the southern colonies and the British colonies of North America. And there they were sold to work on sugar plantations in the Caribbean or cotton plantations in the mainland. And then the raw sugar or the raw cotton was brought back across the Atlantic to Britain, to Bristol, to Liverpool and so on. Now, that same year, Wilberforce made it clear that guilt could not be sidestepped. If you think of a parallel in Scripture, think of the prayer of Daniel in Daniel chapter 9. The way that Daniel identified himself with the guilt of the nation. Now, you might feel, for instance, that Daniel, at least, was not implicated. You know, you could say, Daniel, you're the best man in Israel. You, at least, can exempt yourself from the guilt. But think again of Wilberforce. "I mean not to accuse anyone, but to take the shame upon myself, in common indeed with the whole Parliament of Great Britain, for having suffered this horrid trade to be carried on under their authority. We are all guilty. We ought all to plead guilty, and not to exculpate ourselves by throwing the blame on others." He faced numerous obstacles along the way. Powerful vested interests supported the slave trade. On the one hand, there was the simple appeal to patriotism. In the 1790s and early 1800s, few men had caught the nation's imagination quite like Admiral Nelson, for his stunning naval victories against the Spaniards and the French. Nelson once roundly declared as follows: "I was bred in the good old school and taught to appreciate the value of our West Indian possessions, and neither in the field," meaning the field of battle, "nor the Senate, shall their just rights be infringed while I have an arm to fight in their defence or a tongue to launch my voice against the damnable doctrine of Wilberforce and his hypocritical allies. Now, just pause and reflect. For a man like Nelson to say, while I have an arm to fight in their defence, everybody knew that Nelson had lost an arm. It's a loaded statement from a man who has paid a heavy price in the defence of his country's interests. Now, it was also argued sometimes that for a mercantile nation, a trading nation like the United Kingdom, to abolish the slave trade, that would be tantamount to economic suicide. In the same way that it's sometimes argued nowadays that if the United Kingdom were to act unilaterally and abandon its nuclear deterrent, it would be highly unlikely that other nations that possessed similar weapon systems would abandon theirs. It was then argued that other nations who were our chief competitors for world markets and whose economies profited from the cheap labour that African slaves provided would continue to do so. In other words, Britain would be deprived of an economic asset while France, Spain, Portugal and so on would continue to reap the benefit. They would still have slaves. They would still have the advantages of having the cheap labour that slaves would provide. There were also rumblings from within the West Indies, where the plantation elites had everything to lose if an economic system based entirely on slavery were disbanded. And some of the island parliaments were occasionally trying to spike the guns of abolitionists in Westminster by declaring that they would break their ties with Britain and federate with the newly independent United States of America. You got the idea? You know, that the plantation elite in Jamaica would occasionally say, well, if you abolish slavery, tell you what we'll do, we'll clear off and we'll join the Americans and see how you like it if we do. At other times, Wilberforce was faced with crude threats of physical violence intended to intimidate him into silence. In 1790, a slave ship captain named Robert Norris had threatened to murder Wilberforce. Now, in the end, it turned out to be an empty threat, but 2 years later, there were two other incidents. Firstly, another slaver named Rolleston challenged him to a duel. That was deflected easily enough. Wilberforce's views on dueling were well known. He was opposed to it. Also that year, a Captain John Kimber was acquitted on a charge of murder when a slave girl on a ship that he commanded died after severe maltreatment. Wilberforce made his disgust at this acquittal plain in the House of Commons, so Kimber countered with a demand for a public apology, compensation of £5,000 and a government job to make him comfortable for life. Wilberforce refused, so Kimber began to stalk him in public, and for most of the next 2 years, Wilberforce needed an armed bodyguard. At times, Wilberforce faced cynical delaying tactics. There was an occasion in 1792 when a Member of Parliament named Henry Dundas scuppered his bill. Wilberforce tried to get the bill introduced every single year, and this man simply got the word gradual inserted into it. The gradual abolition of slavery. And then in March 1796, yet another bill was lost simply through the apathy of Wilberforce friends. The vote was taken, the House divided, the bill was lost by 74 votes to 70, and Wilberforce was broken-hearted when he realised that enough of his friends had gone to the opera that night to have guaranteed that it would have been passed if they'd simply showed up. In fact, it provoked something like a mental breakdown on his part for about 6 months. He was so upset at the way things had gone. Now, for much of this time, Wilberforce also had the added frustration of knowing that the United Kingdom was at war with France almost continually for the whole of the period, from 1792 onwards. And at least until Nelson's decisive victory over the combined fleets of France and Spain at Trafalgar in 1805. Now, you see, from then on, there was no real possibility of a French invasion. But prior to that, there was at least the token possibility. Anybody with a telescope could stand on the White Cliffs of Dover and actually look at Boulogne and see French barges being assembled to bring an invasion army across the channel. Now, prior to that, anybody could say to Wilberforce, you see, you've got your priorities all wrong. We're facing the real possibility of invasion here. Now, older friends here who can remember 1940 and how things stood when English people were seriously worried about an invasion threat then might be able to identify with the sense of panic that there was at the time, and how people might argue with Wilberforce and say to him, look, slavery might be a great moral evil, but what we're up against here, Wilberforce, is the real possibility that our nation itself might go under. Don't you think that this should be at least put off until we've staved off this invasion threat? So all of this is there in the background. But at least after Trafalgar, well, at that point, apparently the First Sea Lord, Admiral Sir John Jervis, once said to a rather nervous collection of politicians, "My lords, I do not say the French cannot come, I only say they cannot come by sea." The climax finally came after 20 years. Would you have the patience to pursue one objective for 20 years? On the night of the 23rd of February 1807. By this time, Wilberforce's old ally William Pitt had died the previous year, and Lord Grenville was now Prime Minister, assisted by Charles James Fox, both men, incidentally, with whom Wilberforce had quarrelled in the days before his conversion. During the course of the debate, the Prime Minister made a generous tribute to Wilberforce, but the best speech of the night, and it was a debate that went on almost all night, was given by Sir Samuel Romilly, who made what was at first sight a strange comparison. He asked the House to compare the homecomings of two men, Napoleon and William Wilberforce. Incidentally, just if you like matters of detail and if you like quirky things, both small men. Napoleon stood at about 5'2". He pictured the little Corsican general arriving in Paris to a tumultuous welcome, cheering crowds. But the grim fact was that his triumph was achieved through slaughter and death on the grand scale. But on the other hand, Wilberforce would go home to the bosom of his happy and delighted family, able to lie down in peace because he'd preserved so many millions of his fellow creatures. Now, it was one of those moments when the House of Commons was at its best. Almost the entire House stood as one man, and facing Wilberforce, cheered wildly, hats in the air. And the little member for Yorkshire, sometime after his election for Hull, he'd stood again for the county seat of Yorkshire. He sat on his bench, his head in his hands, and sobbed and sobbed. It was the release, you see, of 20 years of emotional energy all pent up, and he was in floods. And when the House divided, ayes 283, noes 16. In the early hours of the morning, in his home at Clapham Common, he turned to his cousin, Henry Thornton, and asked him, "Well, Henry, what shall we abolish next? And his cousin said to him, the lottery, I think. Let me turn now to a related topic. The saints. I'm referring now to a group of friends who were known later on, but not in their own lifetime, as the Clapham sect. In the spring of 1792, this man I mentioned just now, Henry Thornton, he'd purchased a house called Battersea Rise. It's a handsome estate on the southwest side of Clapham Common. Clapham was at that time a pleasant rural hamlet, 2 or 3 miles south of London. Thornton's father John was a wealthy merchant, grown rich by astute trading in the Baltic. A devout Anglican evangelical who'd contributed £200 a year to support John Newton's ministry, gave generously to evangelical causes of all kinds. He'd helped to found Dartmouth College in America. Now Henry Thornton, his son, had become a considerable figure in his own right. He has a deserved place, interestingly, in the history of monetary theory and the development of the British banking system, as well as the cause of the abolition of slavery and other moral issues, for which he's better known. In 1802, he wrote an inquiry into the nature and effects of the paper credit of Great Britain. Because of the war with France, the government had introduced paper money for the first time in the country as an emergency wartime measure. And if you think of the way that the banknotes that we have on them, I promise to pay the bearer on demand at the sum of £5. Or as it used to say on the old £1 note, the sum of £1. You see, your banknote isn't £5. It's a promise to give you £5 in gold. It's not £5 as such. It's an IOU for £5. Henry Thornton was explaining that your promissory note was as good as gold. That's where the phrase came from. Because initially, when people were given these pieces of paper, they were a bit nervous. Now, in 1792, this man was still a young bachelor, and partly with a view to sharing the expenses of his new home, just like when students rent a house together when they're away at university, and partly with a view to enjoying the fellowship of a favourite Christian companion, he proposed to Wilberforce that between them they set up what he called a chummery. And this was how an unofficial group of friends together came about, which eventually was known as the Clapham sect. For the first few months it was just the two of them, two cousins, but they discovered by happy accident that they had complementary personalities that meshed, and somehow together they were more than they were apart. Thornton was a natural organiser, almost a born chairman and planner. Wilberforce, for his part, was noted for his sparkling conversation and general amiability. He was so personable that he made Christianity attractive. The Prince Regent, I better explain, the king at the time was George III, but he had periodic fits of insanity. The poor man was affected with a disease called porphyria. It was an organic disease, and it seems partly to have come about because he was badly medicated, actually. Have you seen the movie The Madness of King George? There's a rumour, incidentally, that it was going to be called The Madness of George III, but they called it The Madness of King George because it wouldn't have worked in America. Because if they'd said The Madness of George III, American audiences would have wondered about The Madness of George I and The Madness of George II. And hope there are no Americans present in case that gets me a good kicking afterwards. But yeah, I mean, the poor man had this complaint, porphyria, On one occasion, reputedly, he shook hands with a tree in Hyde Park, thinking it was the Prussian ambassador. So sometimes he just had to be put away for his own good, and his son ruled as Prince Regent. He didn't become king in his own right till 1820, as George the Fourth. But the Prince Regent was a dissolute man. He was not a moral man, but he once said that he would go anywhere to hear Wilberforce sing. Now, don't be surprised, it was a drawing room accomplishment for a gentleman at the time. It was part of any gentleman's education. But Henry Thornton went on to build two other houses either side of Battersea Rise along one side of the common, and some of his friends moved in, also evangelical Anglicans, also committed to the cause of abolition. One was called Edward Elliot, the other was Charles Grant. Grant had recently returned to England from India. He had this to say of Wilberforce: "I'm in hopes that some good may come of our Clapham system. Wilberforce is a candle that should not be hid under a bushel. The influence of his conversation is great and striking. I'm surprised to find how much religion everybody seems to have when they come to our house. They seem all to submit and to acknowledge the advantage of a religious life, and we're not at all thought guilty of carrying things too far." Grant's presence in the group gave an Indian dimension to the group's interests and led to another 20-year struggle. The Baptist missionary, William Carey, was not permitted to pursue his calling in any territory under the jurisdiction of the British-owned East India Company. He was only able to remain in India at all because there was a tiny Danish-owned enclave named Sorampore, and the Danish authorities gave him permission to remain there. Wilberforce, Thornton, and others among the Clapham Circle mounted a long campaign to get government approval for missionary activity in India, as well as for such things as the abolition of the practice of the burning of widows on their husbands' funeral pyres. Christian missionaries were finally given permission to operate in East India Company-owned territory in 1813. In March 1793, the Clapham Circle acquired its chaplain when a man named John Venn was appointed to the living of Holy Trinity Church on the north side of the common. He was a shy man, but a gifted preacher, whose sermons attracted enormous congregations that filled the capacious church building. The lawyer James Stephen joined the group in 1794. He had lived on the Caribbean island of St. Kitts, where he was repelled by what he saw of slavery in practice. He married Wilberforce's sister Sarah, so it wasn't the case of Miss Wilberforce forever. And he used his formidable legal skills to draft the successful bills of 1807 and 1833. The Clapham Circle published its own magazine called The Christian Observer, edited by a man named Zachary Macaulay, who spent most of the 1790s as governor of Sierra Leone. Now that's interesting, it's a colony in West Africa, and it was deliberately created to provide a home for freed slaves from West India sent back to West Africa. Now, the phrase Clapham sect was originally a derisory term coined several decades later. At the time, the group were mockingly called the Saints. Wilberforce eventually left Clapham and moved to Kensington Gore, more or less where the Albert Hall now stands, to be nearer to Parliament, but he looked back on his time there with great affection. It's sometimes been described as a meeting that never adjourned. As we've seen, it actually began in an outwardly haphazard way when two young bachelors came together just to share a home, but it lasted for almost two decades. A tightly knit group of Anglican evangelicals, mostly but not all in Parliament, they made common cause to serve God and their generation. Their achievements included founding the British and Foreign Bible Society, the Church Missionary Society, and more practical things like the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. One figure who was a kind of honorary member was a lady named Hannah Moore, a lady with a considerable literary past, and she was once described as a bishop in petticoats. She persuaded Wilberforce and Thornton to help set up schools for village children in the remote Mendip Hills in Somerset, much against the opposition of the village clergy, including the vicar, who was habitually drunk and sporting black eyes from getting involved in drunken brawls in the local pub. It also enjoyed the vigorous support of Charles Simeon in Cambridge, and though he was by no means an Anglican, the independent minister William Jay in Bath, who functioned as a kind of unofficial chaplain when members of the circle were in the city of Bath taking the waters. It was Jay, incidentally, who said of Wilberforce that he was good among the great and great among the good. It's a lovely epitaph, that, isn't it? Good among the great and great among the good. I'd like to say something about Wilberforce's family life now, if I may. 5 years after he died, in 1838, just hoping none of you are quick with your maths there, the five-volume life of William Wilberforce appeared, and it became a staple of middle-class Victorian Sunday reading. And this work made much of his devotion to his wife and children, and the pattern of family prayers in the Wilberforce household. And a volume of his family prayers have been published separately in 1834. But in view of all this, it's surprising to note that he didn't marry until he was 37. His bride, Barbara Spooner, was just 20 at the time, and they married after a whirlwind courtship of 6 weeks. He proposed by letter, and she accepted him also by letter. He confided in his diary, "I believe she's admirably suited to me. A real Christian, affectionate, sensible, rational in habits, moderate in desires and habits, capable of bearing prosperity without intoxication." That doesn't mean anything to do with drink, incidentally. It means getting giddy about it. And adversity without repining. They were together for 36 years, and he said this about her: "A more tender, excellent wife no one ever received as a gift from the Lord." They had 6 children within 10 years. It was a pious home, and later Victorians regarded it as a role model, but it was certainly not the stereotype of the 19th century home where children were kept away from parents by an army of governesses and nannies. Wilberforce loved the company of his children and often played with them. He once seriously injured his leg while playing cricket with his oldest son William. Now, when you consider that he was what age when he married? 37? And if he's playing cricket with his boy, he would be in his late 40s. He'd probably have been better off playing a more sedate game by that stage in his life. But one of his letters explains that he had to break off the letter and come back to it later. He said that he'd been irresistibly summoned to a contest at marbles. And this intrigues me. In honour of the coronation of King George IV, he provided ale and cricket for the servants and all the family. That's 1820. I can't imagine half a century after that that an evangelical from a prosperous background would provide ale and cricket for the servants for a festive occasion. You know, the evangelical culture had changed by then. Can you imagine evangelicals in the 1870s providing beer for their servants for a... And it just goes to make an interesting point that temperance was not always a given among evangelicals. Now, at Kensington Gore, there was a Twelfth Night party in 1815 where Wilberforce and his guests all played blind man's buff for 2 hours or more. And his children's diaries include references to such treats as being taken to see jugglers, going to the British Museum, their father arranging for his friend William Allen, a Quaker and an eminent scientist, astronomer and member of the Royal Society, to come to the home and carry out chemical experiments for them. He would play chess with them, read from the Arabian Nights or Shakespeare, and as they grew up and moved away, he corresponded with them. Over 600 letters to his third son, Samuel, and by the way, as Bishop of Oxford, Samuel took part in the famous debate with T.H. Huxley over Darwin's theories, have survived. Visitors found Wilberforce an engaging host. His friend James McIntosh once observed that he had a remarkable gift for being interested in almost any topic of conversation. If I were called upon to describe Wilberforce in one word, I should say that he was the most amusable man I ever met in my life. Instead of having to think of what subjects will interest him, it's perfectly impossible to hit one that does not. I never saw anyone who touched life at so many points, and this is the more remarkable in a man who's supposed to live absorbed in the contemplation of a future state. When he was in the House of Commons, he seemed to have the freshest mind of any man there. There was all the charm of youth about him. Well, let's talk about finishing the course. The last 2 decades of Wilberforce's life were marked by increasing ill health. His eyesight was poor, and he became increasingly dependent on the services of a reader. You know, he employed a man to read his letters to him, to read the scriptures to him. He'd always been a small man, but as the years passed, this was accentuated because he increasingly suffered from curvature of the spine. Very few people outside his close family knew that he wore a padded steel brace under his clothing to correct this, but he accidentally left one behind at the home of Lord Calthorpe, and when he wrote requesting its return, he said, "How gracious is God in giving us such mitigations and helps for our infirmities." If you ever look at any of the biographies and see a portrait taken of him in old age, you can see this remarkable curvature of the spine in the way that his chin is right down on his chest. The medical profession of his day did not appreciate the dangers of morphine dependency and the fact that he was taking opium 3 times a day. Do you remember I mentioned as a young man he had this prescription of opium and he took it for the rest of his life, and it wasn't actually appreciated. He was, in modern terms, a heroin addict. But it wasn't understood that the dangers of this. His continuing involvement in the fight to see slavery abolished altogether also saw some cruel disappointments. The early 19th century was not without its equivalent of the charity begins at home lobby, and there were those willing to assert that Wilberforce had done nothing at all for the labouring poor of England. Suffering in the dark satanic mills, and one of the nastiest such attacks came from the radical MP William Cobbett. What do you think of this? "You seem to have a great affection for the fat and lazy and laughing and singing and dancing Negroes, but never have you done one single act in favour of the labourers of this country. You make your appeal in Piccadilly amongst those who are wallowing in luxuries, proceeding from the labour of the people. You should have gone to the gravel pits and made your appeal to the wretched creatures with bits of sacks round their shoulders and with hay bands round their legs. You should have gone to the roadside and made your appeal to the emaciated, half-dead things who are there cracking stones to make the roads as level as a die for the tax-eaters to ride on. What an insult it is! And what an unfeeling, what a cold-blooded hypocrite must he be that can send it forth, What an insult to call upon people under the name of free British labourers to appeal to them in behalf of black slaves when these free British labourers, these poor, mocked, degraded wretches, would be happy to lick the dishes and bowls out of which the black slaves have breakfasted, dined or supped. Cobbett knew that this was grossly unfair. It was public knowledge that Wilberforce had been involved in many initiatives to help the disadvantaged in Britain as well as abroad. Actually, John Pollock, one of Wilberforce's biographers, has calculated that at one stage Wilberforce was involved in 61 different initiatives, as well as his help for the slaves. What would never be known was the extent of his private charities. For some time before he married, for instance, he'd resolved to try and live on a quarter of his income so that he could help those in need. There was also sadness within the family circle. His older daughter Barbara died of consumption at 32, shortly after Christmas in 1821. His oldest son, William, proved a constant worry. For many years there was no sign of the great change that the father had known and longed to see in his son. One diary entry reads, "Oh, my poor William, how strange he can make so miserable those who love him best and whom really he loves. His soft nature makes the sport of his companions and the wicked and idle naturally attach themselves like dust and cleave like burrs. I go to pray for him. Alas, could I love my Saviour more and serve him, God would hear my prayer and turn his heart." Now, do you get that? Wilberforce is really saying, it's my fault that my son isn't a Christian. If I were more godly and were praying harder, God would save my son. When news came home that William was missing lectures and squandering his allowance at Cambridge, Wilberforce tried to discipline him by cutting the allowance. There was a tragic outcome to all this. In 1825... Wilberforce had retired from Parliament and bought a home called Highwood Hill, near Mill Hill in Hendon Parish, fully expecting to see out his days there. Just 6 years later, Wilberforce was left with no option but to sell it. William had incurred debts of £50,000, a sum worth several million at current values. In a failed business venture, and his father felt compelled to guarantee his son's debts. Friends rallied round and offered to meet all Wilberforce's expenses, but he wouldn't have it, except in the case of a church at Mill Hill that he'd been helping to fund. He'd been wanting to build a church and put an evangelical minister into it. William and Barbara spent the final 2 years of their lives spending 6 months of each year in the homes of their other two sons. Both were clergymen. Samuel was rector of Brightstone on the Isle of Wight. Robert was rector of East Farley in the Medway Valley in Kent. It was extremely sad to think that a man who'd actually spent several fortunes helping others was reduced to such straits by the fecklessness of his son. For some time now he'd ceased to be the effective leader of the campaign for the abolition of slavery, handing over the reins to a young Quaker MP named Thomas Fowell Buxton. His last appearance at a meeting of the Anti-Slavery Society in London was on the 15th of May, 1830. 2,000 people crowded into the Freemasons' Hall when, to great acclaim, Thomas Clarkson invited him to take the chair. It was almost his last public act on behalf of the cause of abolition. Apart from a brief cameo appearance in Maidstone in January, 1833, I say, and say honestly and fearlessly, that the same being who commands us to love mercy also says do justly. And looking around the room, the old man, frail and stooped, his voice feeble, if as eloquent as ever, went on, I trust that we approach the very end of our career. At that point, the ray of light shone through the hall. Well, he hadn't lost his sense of timing. He seized the moment. The object is bright before us, the light of heaven beams on it, and is an earnest of success. In May, he went to Bath, suffering from influenza, and hoping that the waters would help to recover his health. But after 2 months, it was clear that he was in decline. In July, he went to London to consult an eminent physician, Dr. Chambers, who'd once helped him in the past. He stayed at 44 Cadogan Place, a house lent by his cousin, Lucy Smith. One morning, he received a visit from a young Member of Parliament, one William Ewart Gladstone, who wrote of him, "He is cheerful and serene, a beautiful picture of old age in sight of immortality. Heard him pray with his family. Blessing and honour are upon his head." During the night of Friday the 26th, the bill for the abolition of slavery passed its second reading in the House of Commons, which made its eventual success guaranteed. It included the provision that £20 million would be paid to purchase the freedom of slaves throughout all British dominions. The news was brought to Wilberforce, the last news that he ever received from Parliament. It was almost 50 years since he introduced a bill to abolish the slave trade in the dying days of 1787. His response? "Thank God that I should have lived to witness a day in which England is willing to give 20 million sterling for the abolition of slavery." Now, of course, it could be said that nothing was given to compensate the slaves. But still, politics is the art of the possible, and it did mean that throughout all the dominions of the empire, slaves would now be set free. 2 days later, on Sunday the 28th of July, it was clear that he was sinking. To his son Henry, he said, "I'm in a very distressed state." "Yes," Henry replied, "but you have your feet set on the rock." Self-effacing to the last, the old man said, "I do not venture to speak so positively, but I hope I have." At 3 a.m. on the following day, now remember this, the man who could have been Prime Minister when the United Kingdom brought Napoleon to defeat at Waterloo, think of the name he would have had if he had been, breathed his last. Soon after, within a couple of hours, the family received a letter from the Lord Chancellor, Henry Brougham, bearing the signatures of many members of both Houses of Parliament. "We, the undersigned, members of both Houses of Parliament, being anxious upon public grounds to show our respect for the memory of the late William Wilberforce, and being also satisfied that public honours can never be more fitly bestowed than upon such benefactors of mankind, earnestly request that he may be buried in Westminster Abbey, and that we may have permission to attend his funeral." During the procession, the Duke of Wellington, a tall, spare man with a very prominent nose, who was always recognised, was seen in the funeral procession. And, of course, wherever he went, the Iron Duke, as he was known, always got a cheer. One of the great heroes of the day. Well, he was seen, and hats were off immediately, and he looked. Fingers to the lips. On his memorial statue in Westminster Abbey, there's this tribute from Lord Macaulay. "In an age fertile in great and good men, he was among the foremost of those who fixed the character of their times, because to high and various talents he added the abiding eloquence of a Christian life." You've been a very patient audience.